Up next, look at what the future on Earth might hold from a man who has spent a lot of time, most of his life, studying the past. In his new book, Fossil Hunter, Mike Novacek turns his attention to the threat we face on Earth today, a population that may reach 9 billion by the middle of the century, ever-increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, air pollution, lack of fresh water. And Dr. Novacek points out that the threats to the Earth's ecosystem and life that depends on it are coming fast and furious. And he now joins us to talk more about it. And if you'd like to get in on our conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also join Science School and Second Life. Look for us with the Science Friday T-shirts on it and ask us questions here on Science Friday. Dr. Novacek is Provost of Science and Senior Vice President at the American Museum of Natural History here in New York. And the formal title of his book is Terra, Our 100-Million-Year-Old Ecosystem and the Threats That Now Put It at Risk. And he's here now in our New York Bureau. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Novacek.
Thank you, Art.
Before we get to the book, let me do some housekeeping. It's great to have you here in a good week to have
okay.
a scientist on call.
Yeah.
Because let's talk first about a new dinosaur that just got unveiled, the Nigersaurus. Some scientists are calling it a Mesozoic cow.
Right. Yeah, it's a pretty weird-looking animal. There's no question. And that dentition, those tiny teeth out in the front of that spatula-like jaw, upper and lower jaw, is pretty wild looking. I can't think of another dinosaur with a mouth that broad. Although some of the duck-billed dinosaurs have some pretty, the hadrosaurs have some pretty weird jaws as well. But it's a fascinating animal, and you know, it just underscores the point that we're finding new dinosaurs and new fossils all the time.
Yeah, this was a sort of a grazing, like a cow, a grazing dinosaur.
Yeah, and I think this has been thought before. You know, there have been some studies that showed that dinosaurs, certain of these long-necked sauropods, couldn't raise their neck as high to you know, crop foliage, to do the treetop topiary that a lot of these paintings show, a lot of the reconstructions show. And there's some ingenious computer reconstructions by various scientists that show these things are mainly grazing like cantilever, you know, but like cranes, and grazing over ferns and grasses and such. And this animal looks like it might have been doing the same.
It's amazing how you find these places and places you don't expect to find them.
Yeah.
Dinosaurs.
Well, it's amazing. The amount of discovery, the new discoveries of fossils and other dinosaurs seem to be accelerating, not slowing down as we begin the 21st century.
Do you have any new digs you're on, or
well,
exciting places you're looking at?
I can't walk away from Mongolia. We had our 18th season in Mongolia in the Gobi Desert. It's really one of the great treasure lands, dinosaur and other fossil hunting lands in the world. And we did spend, we've been working some newer localities there in the eastern Gobi over the last couple of years. They're really producing some very cool stuff. So we're very, very excited about that.
Finding more eggs and bird-like features?
This set of units, not as many eggs as the other beds we worked some years ago when we found the dinosaur embryos and the nesting dinosaurs. But we're finding a lot of very small juvenile dinosaurs in this site, and some different kinds. And some of the mammals are really fascinating, too. They're new animals, so we're very happy.
People tend to forget that there may have been some mammals around at the same time.
Yeah, it's something I have to keep reminding them about, because I'm very fat. I found a lot of dinosaurs, but I'm more fascinated in some of the mammals that got trampled underfoot. And because, for the very simple reason, is those mammals around that time, we're talking about the end of the dinosaur age, they really foreshadow modern mammals, including ourselves. So they're very important from an evolutionary perspective.
There's also a theory that's being brought up again this week about the possibility that it wasn't an asteroid or a giant body hitting the Earth that wiped out the dinosaurs, but volcanic activity.
Yeah, I don't think people will ever stop arguing about the nature of the Cretaceous extinction event and what caused it. And again, we have this theory emerging or being proposed that these massive volcanic eruptions contributed more to the extinction event than other people would have it. I've heard those theories offered before in different ways. And, of course, I'm still persuaded that the asteroid impact itself, is the timing is very close to the extinction event. And also, you know, the scenarios about that are rather dramatic. Mm-hmm. When something this size, bigger than Mount Everest, hits the Earth, it's going to cause a lot of problems.
I'm glad, it happened before, not now. 1-800-989-825 is our number. Talking with Michael Novacek, author of Terror, Our 100-million-year-old Ecosystem and the Threats That Now Put It at Risk. As someone who's out there in the Gobi and other places digging for the ancient history, I read the fear that you have in this book about the future.
Well, I think what one really appreciates if you're a paleontologist is how ephemeral life is. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just these major mass extinction events. We think of the lump, some of those as five major events that occurred over the course of hundreds of millions of years at very short intervals. But extinction's happening all the time. And many species, what we say on average, most species don't last probably more than a million years. But then when you look around you and you see the devastation of ecosystems and habitats on Earth, the extinction of species, you say, wow, this is happening right now. And couple that with things in the physical system, climate mm-hmm. change and global warming, and you've got a rather dramatic event. If I were a paleontologist living 10 million years from now and looking back at this record, I might say, this is a fascinating thing. You know, this is a major extinction event we're recording now in the fossil record. You know, it's 10 million years since. And so I think it's something of concern since we're the cause. And theoretically, that means we could do something about it.
We'll come back and talk lots more about what those possibilities might be. Talking with Michael Novacek, author of Terra, Our 100-million-year-old Ecosystem and the Threats That Now Put It at Risk. Stay with us. Our number 1-800-989-8255. We'll be back. Take your questions. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour with Michael Novacek, author of Terra, our 100-million-year-old Ecosystem and the Threats That Now Put It at Risk. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's take a phone call or two. Adam in Lawrence, Kansas. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, I'd like to offer this question to anyone like from different expertises, and I mean, the threat of global warming is so obvious, and what do you think we as American people and citizens of the world should do to change the mindset of our politicians, our business leaders, and just like the normal person to finally counteract all these threats?
Yeah, Dr. Novacek, what can we do?
Well, I think it's a phase process. It takes three or four major steps, and I think the first step is a change in behavior, actually. And change in the way we consume energy, the hybrid technologies that are available today, I'm a believer in. I drive a Honda Insight myself. I've had it for years. It gets 70 miles to a gallon of gas. People used to laugh at me when I drove that car. Someone once asked me, does that thing go underwater? You know?
I've never heard that one before.
Now nobody's laughing as the price of gas approaches $100 a barrel. You know, I think that changes in behavior are an important thing. We know we can save, but that's not enough. We have to develop alternative energy options. Technology may even have to store carbon. We don't have perfect ways of doing that yet.
You talk about sequestration.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And so, there are many issues there. One is the technology that's practical and usable and even exists. The other is where do you store it? Some of the options there are not too attractive. You don't want to dump it back into the sea and create another problem. I think it is a phased-in process, and it's going to take many decades. What I worry about is sometimes there's so much focus on the climate change issue that we also, and it is important, and I wouldn't at all deny that, but we sometimes lose sight that it's the double whammy or the combined effects of land loss and climate that really poses huge environmental threats to us. It's the combination of a lot of these factors.
Mm-hmm. You also talk a lot, you spend a lot of time in your book talking about air pollution, which is not the same as greenhouse gases in particular. Why air pollution?
Well, in a sense, pollution is obviously an environmental disruptor, not only creates dangerous for human life, but it also destroys ecosystems or destroys habitats. Acid rain's a good example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in another way, the reason I talked at length about air pollution is, in a sense, one can think of climate change as a byproduct of air pollution. So when you have a lot of pollution, the last thing people were probably imagining when they were creating all this pollution was, well, we're going to change the climate. They're probably more worried about the condition of their lungs and the breathability of the air. But here we have an insidious other effect of this cause. And so I think it's important to talk about the primary causes there.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from, I guess, Anama Deepni in Second Life wants to know what it would take to have humanity go extinct short of a nuclear war. Are we talking about that possibility now?
Well, I think one should accept the possibility of extinction in humans first, simply because that has occurred in other organisms, many organisms which have lasted much longer than we have. So that is one thing. Now, how fast would it occur? It's very difficult to say. I think the scenario that I'm more concerned about in terms of at least the near-term future, is that we might survive, but we might survive in an ambience, if you will, in an environment, in an ecosystem that's not very nice to survive in, you know. Mm-hmm. If we're sharing the planet totally overrun with rats and cockroaches and other species that reproduce like weeds and adapt to degraded environments, this is not particularly a quality of life. And it will put us in dangers, other dangers, including our health. Right. And certainly the world for our children will be even worse than what we see for ourselves in the near term.
It doesn't seem like, I mean, the U.S. is late to this party in terms of European countries, but how do we convince the big developing countries like China and India to come to dance at this party also?
It's a hugely complex political issue. It is a global issue, and that's an undeniable reality. One can also see that these countries view themselves as developing nations because their economies and their technologies have boomed in only recent years. But since China will surpass the U.S. and Europe combined in CO2 emissions in a few short years, that it doesn't seem to the category of being a developing country is very realistic label for that, for China. And so the amount of international cooperation required here is immense, and that's going to be a difficult political problem. It takes world leadership. It takes world leadership in this country, as well as China, India, and other countries that are producers.
1-800-999-8255 is our number. Talking with Michael Novacek, author of Terra, Our 100-Million-Year-Old Ecosystem and the Threats that Now Put It at Risk. Let's see if we can go to take a phone call or two to Shrek in Louisville. Hi, Shrek.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment, and I was wondering how your guests would respond to it. I think it's a little misleading when we talk of the threat to the planet, because I think the planet's going to do just fine. It's seen some pretty dramatic changes in the past, mass extinctions, as you were talking about, and the biosphere, you know, evolution being as powerful as it is, it's just going to move on and find a different equilibrium. I think what we should be really talking about is a very real and immediate threat to humanity. Because I think when we don't do that, when you talk about the threat to the planet, then it's very easy for people to sort of dismiss it as a kind of an altruistic save the whale sort of a phenomenon. But what we're really talking about is our existence.
Yeah, difference. The planet will go on for a while, right?
I can understand the point of view there. It's not we're not threatening the planet is not at risk. But as the title of my book says, what is at risk is this 100-million-year-old ecosystem, the ecosystem that we depend on for food. And one of the arguments I make there is that this ecosystem hasn't been around for all of the history of life, for the 3.5 billion year history. It's been around for 100 million years. It emerged during the time of the dinosaurs. It's largely defined by flowering plants and the pollination by insects. And those flowering plants, many of them produce the 1,500 or so crop species that humans depend on. So we're part of this ecosystem. Now, yes, I think it's a threat to humanity, but it's also a threat to humanity and its connections with this modern ecosystem. That's important. Life can rebound after extinction, as I discuss in the book, mm-hmm. but that could take tens of thousands or millions of years for a kind of equilibrium that we now have to reemerge.
And there are people now talking about, you know, and you mention in your book, even if we stop dumping all this CO2 into the atmosphere tomorrow, there would still be changes.
That's right.
That'd be taking place.
That's right. That's correct. And in fact, you know, climate will be changing regardless of how effective we are in some of mm-hmm. these conservation measures.
Mm-hmm. We've just got a few minutes left. Let's talk about what's going on at the museum now in case people want to get there over the holidays, which is always a high peak time. We'd love to go to the museum.
Well, we welcome you all, and we've got wonderful, excited visitors there. We just opened the water show, the water exhibition, about 2 or 3 weeks
ago. Skiing? You got water skiing?
No, not water skiing. This is a very serious exhibit, but I should emphasize it's also an exhibit that's great for kids. You get to walk through a fog screen, and the kid just doesn't walk one way. He walks back and forth several times.
Sure.
It has a beautiful, beautiful object in there, a science on a sphere, which shows magnificently changing digital imagery on a sphere. It shows the oceans and the clouds and the atmosphere and teaches you a good lesson about the distribution of water. It's a very important exhibit because people, I think, don't understand how little water, fresh water, is available to humans and how it's distributed on Earth and what we can do to help improve the situation. And I should say there's also a flat exhibit, mainly on photographs, of the water exhibits that's also at the UN, which I think is a highly appropriate place to have our satellite exhibit.
It's good to say you walk by every day and you're reminded about.
Absolutely.
State of
world leaders, and they can look at those places and even see situations that might relate to their own countries.
Yeah, because they say water is the next battleground. That's what we'll all be fighting over.
Mark Twain said, whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting over.
And there you have it. I can't think of a better way to sum that situation up. And thank you, Michael Novacek, who is author of this great new book, Terra, Our 100-Million-Year-Old Ecosystem and the Threats That Put It at Risk. He is a provost of science and senior vice president at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Welcome. Thank you for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Ari. It's a pleasure.